Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here. If you're listening at home, thanks for listening. I'm going to be talking about index theory, which is familiar territory for some of you, I'm sure. Index theory is now a vast multinational enterprise with many different divisions, and so I shall be reporting to you from the functional analysis division of index theory, which is not one of the major divisions represented here at Texas. So I hope I have something at least to tell you. I think the charge of these lectures is to be reasonably close to the ground and educational, so I'll try and do that. I will try and go slowly. Everyone who's speaking has a tendency to go faster and faster and faster and faster. So if that happens and you really want to understand what's going on, just tell me to slow down. Okay. Let me begin at the beginning to tell you what we're ultimately interested in. We'll start with some geometry and then move to functional analysis, and then over the course of several of the several lectures get back to geometry again. Suppose we have a manifold and some sort of first-order operator, first-order partial differential operator. I suppose it has this mysterious Dirac type, just for simplicity. It means that locally, the operator can be expressed something like this. Maybe there's a constant coefficient term as well. So the AJs here are matrix-valued functions, and they satisfy this bizarre algebra, which looks very physical, doesn't it? Something like this, AI, AJ star plus AJ, AI star is equal to, well, it's a choice. This is equal to 2 if I is equal to J, and 0 otherwise. Suppose we have an operator like this. Of course, you have to think about this for a while, but the main example would be this fellow here. So Attia and Singer meditated on the Cauchy-Riemann operator, and after a while they reinvented this more general type of operator, which was first discovered by Dirac. If you have such an operator, of course this is the local picture of it, if you have such an operator, it's a fundamental fact that we'll come back to once or twice in the course of the lectures. That the kernel of the operator, the number of solutions of the operator, is finite. And it's also a fundamental fact, a little harder, that the same thing is true for the co-kernel. So in other words, if you're trying to solve this equation here, then you need only put a finite number of conditions on V for a solution to exist, and when a solution does exist, it's unique up to a finite number of arbitrary constants. That's a consequence of this funny Kabbalistic formula here. And of course, the index is the difference between the two of these fours. And to continue this fundamental fact, this is the same whether or not you count C infinity solutions of the equation, or you count, well, for example, L2 solutions of the equation, or distributional solutions of the equation, they're all the same. And while we're at it, all possible things that you might have to worry about in functional analysis you don't have to worry about. So, for example, for these operators, it's certainly the case that the co-kernel of the operator is the same as the kernel of the formal adjunct. And so on. We'll come back a little bit to discuss why this is so at some point. And the business of index theory, of course, is to study this number and connect it to geometry. And what I want to do is communicate the following message, which is that in index theory, in the sense of Attia and Singer, when you're studying problems, theorems related to this quantity here. It ought to be useful. So first of all, study what are called Fedholm operators. Which is this condition here, as you know, most of you, abstractly. Via, well, for example, functional analysis. And as I say, I'm reporting from the functional analysis division of index theory in particular. Focus on this here, via L2 methods. So what are we talking about here? I don't know, Hilbert spaces, Hilbert space operators, maybe not single operators, but algebras or operators, Sitter algebras, and so on. Okay. You can formulate and prove the Atiyah-Singer index theorem in many, many different ways without knowing what a Sitter algebra is, for example. I mean, that's kind of shameful, but it's true. But that's not what we're going to do. We're going to put some emphasis on abstract, moderately abstract functional analysis and see what we can learn about index theory, which may be a little different from what you can learn about index theory using other sets of tools. Okay. Any questions? Today will be a little bit abstract in the sense that we shan't really talk about particular Dirac operators on particular manifolds. Instead, I want to talk about some of this abstract theory of Fredholm operators and what it has to do, not so much with Dirac operators per se, but with the closely related subject of K-theory. This is relatively old as me. This is a set of ideas which certainly began with some theorems and thoughts of Atiyah in the 1960s. I began in the 1960s, however, Atiyah had nothing to do with that. So okay. Okay. So it's welcome to functional analysis class. We'll spend a little bit of time just reminding ourselves of some very basic issues here. To begin with. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about K-theory, and more particularly I'm going to talk about K-homology, the homological theory, the generalized homology theory, which is dual to K-theory, which has a considerable overlap with functional analysis. K-theory too, and that's what we'll discuss first, but that's somehow less interesting and less deep. But to begin with, let me remind you of a few basic facts about Fredholm operators. An operator between vector spaces is a Fredholm operator, said to be Fredholm if these two conditions hold. And even though it's not directly applicable to Dirac operators, let me consider the following situation. Of a bounded operator between two Hilbert spaces. Bounded Fredholm operator. And to avoid some small issues of functional analysis, we'll say between Hilbert spaces. Okay. To be a Fredholm operator is to be practically invertible, because the condition that I've unfortunately just erased says that the operator is practically one-to-one. I mean, the kernel is finite dimensional, and it's also practically onto. It only misses a finite number of dimensions of the space. And this is where all of the theory of elementary theory of Fredholm operators comes from. So T is It's practically invertible. So when you think about Fred Hom operators for the first time, when you first start learning their basics, you pretend that they're invertible operators, which seems like a funny thing to do. After all, you're interested in the index, and when you made the operator invertible, the index goes away. Nonetheless, this is a good point of view to take. For example, you could do something like this. I mean, suppose we took T0 and suppose we added to it the kernel of T star. And suppose we took H1 and suppose we added to it the kernel of T, like that. And suppose we took an operator which was something like this. Here we'll take, I guess, the projection onto the kernel of T. And here we'll take the operator which is, how to say it, the projection onto the kernel T star. Have that the right way around. Then you get an invertible operator. Now, the number one thing that everyone knows about invertible operators between Banach spaces is that the set of all invertible operators is open. So this little trick, which is written here, which allows you to pass from an operator which is Fredholm to an operator which is invertible, just by adjusting the spaces involved by a finite number of dimensions, this implies, for example, that the set of all Fredholm operators is an open subset of the set of all bounded operators from H0 to H1. In the simplest topology, which is floating around here, which is the so-called norm topology, set of all bounded operators between two Banach spaces is itself a Banach space. The index is a locally constant function. These are all really trivial exercises once you've come upon this trick. Here's another thing which is very important for C-star algebra people. If you have a Fredholm operator and you add to it a so-called compact operator, then the result is again a Fredholm operator with the same index. An operator is compact if it's a limit in this topology that we're speaking of, if it's a limit of finite rank operators. So the compact operators are the closure of the finite rank operators. So every compact operator is a really small operator plus a finite rank operator. The index is clearly, more or less clearly, invariant under finite rank perturbations. It's also invariant under small perturbations. Therefore, it's invariant under compact perturbations. And you can summarize this in a rather nice way. Which is, in our world, called Atkinson's theorem. Which says that a bounded operator between two Hilbert spaces is Fredholm if and only if it's invertible modulo compact operators, modulo the ideal of compact operators. Okay. So that's the basic theory of Fredholm operators, just reminding you of the basic facts that you get by putting this algebraic condition, the Fredholm condition, into the context of Hilbert spaces. You get a few stability results for the Fredholm index that are listed here. And one of the conclusions that you can draw from this is that the space of all Fredholm operators is a reasonable topological space. It's an open subset of a Banach space, so it's a reasonable space. You know, it's locally connected and so on, no horrible general topology nightmares. In fact, the thing has the homotopy type of a CW complex by some general theory, so it's a reasonable space. Let's give it a name, Fred or something. It's a reasonable but really big topological space. Let me assume for the moment that these spaces here are infinite dimensional. And if you're keeping close score, which you shouldn't be because I'm going to lie to you. I'm going to lie to you too, sitting at home. Separable. That won't immediately affect us, but I mention it now because otherwise I'll forget later on. Then there's a very beautiful theorem which I want to discuss a little bit, due to Wittier and also a guy called Yannick, which says that this space that we've just defined is a classifying space for K-theory, the K-theory of topological vector bundles. So the K-theory of space X is the same thing, it's a set of all homotopy classes of maps from X into the space Fred. X is compact. Yeah. This is... We're going to be talking later about K-homology, but this is K-theory of topological vector bundles in the sense of Wittier and Hirzebruch. And I want to discuss this a little bit because... the theorem, what I'm going to do is later on reformulate this theorem, change the theorem, not reformulate it, but alter it, to produce a theorem which is better than this theorem. Yes? Can you say that again, please?
Fred of what? Fred
of what? Fred is shorthand. This is Fred's full name, but Fred just goes by Fred. Oh, of which H0 and H1? It doesn't matter. Fix an H0 and an H1 which are infinite dimensional. All Hilbert spaces are the same, up to isomorphism. So any two Freds that you might meet, no matter what their middle names are actually isomorphic. You know, it's not a concept that applies to people, I guess. But they're clones of one another. Okay. Does it now make sense? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. This is, if I write here, well, can you still see it? This is the space of homotopy classes of maps. In this case, from X into the space Fred. Okay, so let's discuss this a little bit. This is a... Well, I suppose it depends who you are. This is a well-known theorem in certain circles. I want to sketch to you some elements of the proof of this theorem to show you what's difficult about it and what the basic idea is, what the connection is between vector bundles, Fredholm operators, and so on, why the theorem ought to be true. I think it's a good way of warming up to more elaborate things. All right, and how should we begin? Well, here's the basic idea. And then we have to supplement the idea with an observation, and then there are some details. I'll show you one of the details just to be honest. Suppose we have a family F of Fredholm operators parameterized by the space X, and suppose that the dimension of the kernel of F of X, that's an integer-valued function on the space X. Let's suppose that this is locally constant. No law exists which makes this necessarily true, but let's suppose it is true. I mean, the index is locally constant, so whenever there's a jump in the dimension of the kernel, there has to be an equal and opposite, actually an equal jump in the dimension of the co-kernel, but the individual two constituents of the definition of index don't have to be locally constant functions. But let's suppose for a moment it is. Then if we look at these vector spaces, what are they? Well, they're all, of course, subspaces of H0. They constitute a vector bundle. They constitute a continuous, locally trivial family of vector spaces parameterized by the space X. That's a little functional analysis exercise. And it's another little functional analysis exercise. Actually, the way I'm going to write it down. Oh, no. It's another little functional exercise to see that the same thing is true of these fellows. So we can define a sort of index of the family F to be the vector bundle, which is this family of kernels, to be its class in K-theory. The K-theory of a space is the group generated by isomorphism classes of vector bundles subject to a relation, which I won't write down. But here are two vector bundles, and so they define an element, two elements of one abelian group, so does their difference. That we could find the index to be. That certainly looks like a sensible definition. It looks awfully like the definition of index for a single operator, after all. In fact, if X is a point, then the K-theory of X is just the integers, and what I've described is a map which attaches to a Fredholm operator its index. So, well, there you go. That's the idea of the argument. That provides something like a map from here, from the right-hand side of the Atiyah-Yannick theorem to the left-hand side. And let me make just a couple of comments about it. I mean, one thing you have to worry about if you want to prove this theorem is what happens if you actually have a family of Fredholm operators which are all, each of them individually, invertible. In that case, this construction here will give you zero. So it ought to be the case, if the theorem is a theorem, that this family here is zero as well. Okay? And in fact, it is. The famous theorem of Kuiper says that this map here of, I guess it's just called F, isn't it? And F, thought of as a map from X into the space Fred, is homotopic to a constant. If this theorem is true, then the object on the right-hand side ought to be an abelian group, and it is, and the identity element, the zero element of that abelian group, is represented by any constant map. Set of all Fredholm operators is at least connected, so all of the constant maps are homotopic to one another. So this is something that you need if this theorem is going to be true. It's not a trivial theorem. Cannot write down. Nobody knows how to write down an explicit contraction of the space of all invertible operators to a point. It's a contractible space, but nobody knows explicitly why. It just is. Okay, so it's not a trivial fact. Another thing you have to worry about is what if the dimension of the kernel of fx is not locally constant? Well, in that case, you can't do this, and then you're kind of stuck. You know, maybe you need something more general than the K-theory of vector bundles in order to get where you need to go from here to the left-hand side. There's a lovely answer to that, which was really the main contribution of Atiyah and of Yannick in proving this theorem. The other is Kuiper's theorem, which they already had. It's a very clever idea. A little bit of playing around. I actually wrote this up in the notes. I will give these notes, not today, but at some point, to my master here, David, and he will do something with them to make them available to those who are interested in them. Anyway, if you replace F by a product like this, FP, where P is a finite codimension projection, if you choose the right finite codimension projection, it's not hard to see that you can fix the problem. It's actually very easy to see once you know what it is you're supposed to do. This is a consequence of that Atkinson theorem that I wrote before. Once you replace F by F times P, you can make the kernel of the family of operators Fx times P, make all of those kernels equal to the kernel of the projection P. So you've made the family of kernels actually constant, okay, and in particular made it into a vector bundle, and then automatically the family of co-kernels is also constant, locally constant dimensional, and you can form this index here. This fellow here, let's call it F prime, is homotopic to F by the straight line homotopy through Fredholm families by Atkinson's theorem again. So what this observation shows is that within every homotopy class, there is one representative for which this hypothesis holds. And so you're basically there in building a well-defined map from the right-hand side to the left-hand side. Okay, so that's a sketch of, that's the statement of the theorem of Atir and Yannick and a quick indication of the proof. There's actually not anything substantial which I'm not telling you about. If you're a student, you can now fill in the details and hand it in at the beginning of the next lecture, okay, if you want. So the space of all Fredholm operators is a classifying space, the K-theory functor. And so we'll come back to this theorem in a moment. We'll look at this theorem from a different point of view in a little while. But I want to, to look at something else also due to Atir in the meantime, which is a principle of pseudo-locality, if I can spell that. So this is a discussion again. To a T. And it's here where functional analysis gets a little more seriously involved into the matters. Suppose I have a Dirac type operator, something like the Cauchy-Riemann operator on a surface, or some higher dimensional counterpart, a Dirac operator on a higher dimensional manifold, closed manifold. Something which has an index. Let me attempt to put this operator into some of the contexts that we've been discussing here. So let's be a little bit honest here. What's going on maybe is that there are a couple of vector bundles, smooth vector bundles over M, and D is actually mapping sections of one vector bundle sections of another vector bundle like that. Let me make the obvious remark that you cannot differentiate, if you want to stay in the world of honest functions, you cannot differentiate arbitrary L2 functions and get L2 functions back. So this thing isn't defined as an operator from the Hilbert space L2. Of sections of the L2 sections of S0 to the L2 sections of S1. Let me just call this thing, let's call this just now H0 from now on, this thing H1. So even before we start worrying about families of operators, as we were just doing in the Atir-Yannick theorem, there's a bit of a problem here in getting off the ground and making a single elliptic operator, the things that we're really interested in because they have to do with geometry, into an item fit for functional analysts to study. And let me quickly tell you, remind you, how functional analysts after von Neumann deal with this issue. So that's a little bit of a problem. Here's the fix. The first observation is that the operator D can be, if you like, extended. I mean, the set of functions on which it's defined can be enlarged. Here I'm thinking of it as defined on C-infinity functions. There's an operator from C-infinity functions to C-infinity functions. But we can make its domain a little bit bigger. So that the following sort of weak version of continuity holds, namely that if a sequence of functions un converges to u. So what's going on here is that the UNs are supposed to be C infinity. The U, however, is just L2. And the convergence, therefore, ought to be interpreted as convergence in L2. So that if this holds, And if it happens to be the case that the D of un's converge to something, again in L2, then, well, it's possible to extend the domain in such a way that this U is in the domain of the enlarged operator in such a way that D of U is equal to V. What Hilbert space people say is that D is a closed operator. And if you think about it, there's clearly a minimal such extension. Called the closure, and that's one of the things we can do to make D look a little more like a bounded Hilbert space operator. It isn't bounded. On the other hand, there's a sort of vestige of continuity built into these formulas here. This is extremely elementary. What's typically very difficult is to figure out what the domain of the new operator is. That's a very difficult problem in general. But to know that there is a domain, it's very, very elementary. In this particular case where we're dealing with Dirac operators, one can show the domain is a Sobolev space.
Of them
absolutely right.
Go to something non-zero.
That's right. That's an equivalent formulation. If the UNs go to zero, and if the D of UNs converge to something, that something has to be zero. So it's a weak type of continuity for the operator. All right. Now, this is one of the little things that von Neumann figured out back in the pioneering days of Hilbert space, 20s, 10s, I'm not sure, 20s, I guess. Once you've made this extension, you've manufactured out of D a bounded operator, a closed operator. This D has what's called a polar decomposition. So we can write D as some operator A. Maybe I'll write it the other way around. Well, let's do it this way. Times some operator F. And so what you're supposed to think here, so this is a fact not about differential operators. This is a fact about closed operators, for example, about bounded operators. And among the bounded operators are the operators on one-dimensional Hilbert space. Those are the same thing as complex numbers. In the world of complex numbers, what I'm saying is that every complex number can be written as an R times an e to the I theta. That's what it's called. Polar decomposition. And so what's the properties of these two pieces here? Well, the A is given by a very simple formula, which is something that von Neumann made sense of, which is this, that it's, let's see, the way I've written it, it's the square root of D times D star. What von Neumann showed is that any closed operator times D star is what's called a self-adjoint operator, positive self-adjoint operator, which has a certain special meaning to functional analysts. And then you show that every such operator has a square root. Okay. You can think of this just in terms of eigenvalues of matrices, symmetric matrices, if you like. And F here is what's called a partial isometry. So it's an isometry from the orthogonal complement of its kernel into or onto its range. So it's an isometry except for the fact that it has a bit of a kernel. And so here, of course, it's just unitary, but that's a feature of low dimensions. And the kernel of F is the same thing as the kernel of D. And the co-kernel is also the same, the kernel of F star. It's kernel of D star. So this polar decomposition is a way of manufacturing a bounded operator from an unbounded operator, as long as the operator is closed, as long as you've gone to the trouble of dealing with this small enlargement of the domain. So this operator is bounded on Fredholm. And as far as index theory is concerned, it's the same, has the same index as D. In fact, what you should imagine is something like this. This is a positive semi-definite operator or matrix. You should imagine linearly connecting that operator to the identity matrix. That would be through a linear path of positive semi-definite matrices. And when you do that, you'd sort of homotope D, which is an unbounded operator, to F, which is a bounded operator. You should think of A as being totally inessential from the point of view of the homotopy theory of Fredholm operators or families of Fredholm operators. You should think of it being the case from the point of view of K-theory, for example, that D and F are one and the same thing. Okay, but now we've made a bounded operator, which C-star algebra people like better than unbounded operators. And to get back to this issue of pseudo-locality, why bother doing all of this? Well, the reason we do all of this is that a very, very interesting phenomenon, a very interesting feature is retained when we start off with a Dirac operator, not just any old operator, and obtain an F from it. This is something that Attia observed. I will discuss why this is true, not today, but maybe in the next lecture. Here's the fact. Suppose you have a continuous function on M, a scalar-valued function, continuous complex-valued function on M. Well, I can take this function and I can think of it as an operator, as a multiplication operator on the Hilbert space H0 of sections of S0, or the Hilbert space H1 of sections of S1, if you remember the notation. I can think of F as an operator, and then I can form its commutator with the bounded operator F just obtained by this construction here. So that's obviously, well, by this this bracket notation, I just mean the additive commutator like this. This operator is compact. It's a compact operator. It's practically zero. It's practically, well, to be honest, it's practically a finite rank operator, which is practically zero. It's really, really small and insignificant. So this is a big deal, and let me try and explain why. There are tons of, if you're a functional analyst, an operator theorist, even if you're not, you're entitled to look in operator theory journals, and you'll see tons of results like this, such and such a commutator is compact. Operator theorists tend to be obsessed about this. I don't know why. But this particular one has very interesting cohomological consequence, which isn't the case in general. Operator theorists say, okay, it's a compact operator. But operator theorists have a taxonomy of compact operators. They're not satisfied just knowing an operator is compact. They want to know, is it a trace class operator, or is it a Hilbert-Schmidt operator, or is it in the Schatten-P class, and so on. So they write lots of papers about this. Okay. But here's the reason that Attia was interested in this, and that I'm interested in this, and telling you about this right now. Suppose you have a vector bundle. Let's get back to something resembling geometry here. Suppose I have a vector bundle on the space M, the manifold M. Well, it's some sort of abstract thing. You know, maybe it's the complexification of the tangent bundle or something. But we can make it concrete in the following way. We can realize this fellow as a continuous map, as a projection-valued map. Some P, let's say. Let's give the vector bundle a name, E. As a map from the space M into the space of, say, n by n matrices, and each element in the range of this map should be a projection, P squared, or P of M squared is equal to P of M. And then what's the connection between P and the vector bundle? The connection is that the fiber. So we could look at the range of this projection, Cm, Pm, excuse me, and we could call that E sub m, and in this way we build a vector bundle, and conversely, if you have a vector bundle, you can realize it like this. That's one of the basic facts about vector bundles. Now you can do the following thing, which is what Attia did. You can take this projection and you can sort of mix it up with the operator F in the following way. Well, maybe first of all, I should say that we can consider, if you like, P as instead of being a matrix-valued map, you could think of it as a matrix of functions, if you like, a projection in the algebra of matrices over the algebra of continuous functions on M, like that. And once you've gone that far, you could think of this as a projection operator. That's what we were discussing over here. If you have a function, you can think of it not just as a function, you can think of it as a multiplication operator on a Hilbert space of functions. You can do the same thing with this fellow here. So we can build ourselves an operator. Maybe I'll call it P0. We're talking about matrices now. Matrices act not just on scalars, but on vectors. So we need to expand our Hilbert space by... Holy cow. Did I? We need a priest. That's not a signal, is it? I mean... Okay. I'm sure you do. It's a matrix, so right? Matrices act on vectors, column vectors, row vectors, whatever you like. So I can build an operator of this sort. Is it clear what I mean by this? Not very complicated. Okay. And for that matter, you can do the same thing on the Hilbert space H1. They're two operators. They're projection operators. They're more or less characterized by their ranges. And so we could form the following thing. We could take P1 and we could use it to compress a diagonal matrix made out of copies of F. And on the other side, we'll compress with P0. And now we have an operator clearly going from the range of P0 to the range of P1. And the fact that F has this funny analytic property, functional analytic property, is enough to guarantee that this thing here is a Fredholm operator. Because Fredholm is all about being invertible modulo compact operators. And if I have an inverse for F modulo compact operators, I can take that inverse, let's call it G, look at the matrix, the diagonal matrix, G, 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 and that diagonal matrix compressed by P0 on one side and P1 on the other side will be an inverse for F modulo the compact operators. Well, when you multiply them together, you're going to get something like F times some P0 times some g, and you may say to yourself, what about that p0? It's in the way. Well, it's not in the way, because you can move it across f and g by this lemma here, this theorem here. Okay, so this thing here is Fredholm. That's the point that Atiyah noticed. So we get a map, thanks to this theorem, which is now disappearing, using Fredholm index theory, we get a map, and it depends on F, or if you like, on D. And it's a functional on K-theory. It's a way of taking a K-theory element and sort of integrate a vector bundle and integrating it out and getting a number. And a little more generally, using the theorem that we were just discussing, the Atiyah theorem, the Yannick theorem, suppose I have a vector bundle not on M, but on M times any other space X. Now, a vector bundle on M times X is the same thing, think about it, as a family of vector bundles on M parameterized by X. And so we could repeat the entire construction we've just gone through, not with a single vector bundle on M, but now a family of vector bundles on M, and what will come out of it is a family of Fredholm operators parameterized by X. And it has an index, as we were just discussing a moment ago, and it lives in the K-theory of X. Okay. So we get such a map, and it has various nice properties, very easy to see, it's functorial. It's compatible with a certain multiplication structures, ring structures that exist on K-theory and so on. This is what Atiyah observed. Because he knew about the Atiyah-Yannick theorem, and because he knew a thing or two about topology, he was able to put the following things together. First of all, the maps, this family of maps, there's one such map for each auxiliary space X. They determine a class in the whatever it is, an abstractly, indirectly defined K-homology group. Space M. K-theory is a cohomology theory, and for every cohomology theory, there's an equal and opposite homology theory, like ordinary cohomology and ordinary homology. And one of the things you can do with a cycle in homology theory and a cocycle in cohomology theory is you compare them to get a number. And if you're talking about homology over Z, you get an integer. And, well, that's ordinary homology and cohomology for you. The story is exactly the same. In K-theory, there is such a thing as K-homology, whatever it is. The homotopy theorists can tell you what it is. David can tell you what it is. And if you have an element of abstract K-homology, it defines a map on K-theory like this, or fancier maps like this. Okay? And moreover, the only things which define fancy maps like this, which are appropriately functorial in X, are K-homology classes. So the index of D, whatever it is a K-homology class. Maybe we'll call it something like D. I think I will not go into too many details about that, at least right now. Time passes. So that's what Tatir observed. And of course, to make this whole observation work, I started off with an elliptic operator D on an actual manifold, an actual Dirac type operator on an actual manifold. But all I really needed was a bounded Fredholm operator F, which had that key pseudo-locality property that was sitting here a moment ago, that it commute with functions pretty much up to compact operators. Yeah? The class depends on X? No. This construction, first of all, here there is no X, and we have a certain map which has its origins in a certain operator D that we were imagining being given. Okay. Now, if X is any space whatsoever, as long as it's a compact space, we can generalize the construction I outlined here and get a map like this. And what you get is a family of maps now, one for each X, which is considered as a collection of maps. It's compatible with X and maps between different spaces X, maps from X to Y. It's functorial in X. So X is just a placeholder here, just like it is in my daughter's algebra class. Just a variable. D is an operator on M, so D is very much connected. D is an operator, an elliptic operator over the manifold M. The sections on which D actually acts are two other vector bundles which are sort of disappeared from the discussion. They're not part of, they don't appear anywhere here. We call them S0 and S1, and they've disappeared. But of course, to define D, you need to know where it acts, so they're somehow part of the package which is D. Yeah? This, can you say that again?
Is that supposed to be like of a point?
Yes, yes, very good, yes. Yeah, maybe when I said more generally, maybe it wasn't completely apparent. This is the K-theory group of vector bundles on a point. A vector bundle on a point, of course, is just a vector space, and up to isomorphism, it's just a non-zero, non-negative integer. So the K-theory group is the group generated by the non-negative integers, which is the integers. Yes?
Can you choose... So if M is, say, R2, can you choose D in such a way that implements, like,
R3? If M is R2, can you choose D in such a way? The answer is yes, and we'll take a look at that at some point. There's a small proviso, which is that R2 is not a compact space, so you need to think a little bit about how to deal with that non-compactness. One of the things you could do is compactify R2 to get a sphere. On a sphere, there is one obvious operator given by God himself, namely the D-bar operator. The sphere is CP1, and the D-bar operator on CP1 does give the periodicity map, or the inverse to the periodicity map. Any other questions? Well, that sort of stuff will come later. Okay. So you're plodding along and playing around with Fredholm operators, and then if you're a tier, you have this wonderful observation that there's something that you can that's extra. If you have a Fredholm operator, and it came from a Dirac operator, it's not just an operator, not just a Fredholm operator. It's a Fredholm operator with this funny additional property that it more or less commutes with functions. And that's enough to launch you squarely into the realm of algebraic topology. Here we're looking at slant products, Spanier-Whiter dualities floating around in the background, a set of ideas which were very much current and obvious to people in the 1960s studying homotopy theory and topology come into play now and tell you that you get a class in K-homology this way. And what Atira noticed using some work of in cobordism theory is that every class comes this way. Well, more or less. In other words, K-homology, an interesting homology theory, which surely is equally as interesting as K-theory, an interesting homology theory can be built by making cycles, defining cycles to be elliptic operators, which is kind of an interesting set of circumstances. And he asked the following question, which is what I want to answer in the last part of the talk, which is, how can you actually define, from first principles, a homology theory, in particular, the homology theory, which is dual to K-theory, using the objects that he isolated, which are called Fredholm C of X modules. Well, I guess we're talking about M here, C of M modules. So a Fredholm C of M module, let me just write this down. I'm just inventing a term. I'm not inventing a term. This terminology is actually due to Kahn. A term for what we've been looking at here, which is a Fredholm operator between Hilbert spaces. There are C of M actions, representations of this Sestra algebra, if you like, on H0 and H1. And then the key condition, which makes everything tick, is imposed. So a Fredholm module is this collection of data. It's a Fredholm operator between Hilbert spaces. So those Hilbert spaces are equipped with a C of M module structure, you know, appropriate C of M module structure, paying due regard to functional analysis, a representation of the Sestra algebra, and this condition should be satisfied. And I want to describe the answer of Kasparov, which is beautifully simple. It's as simple as the Atir-Yannick theorem. And in the course of formulating the answer, we'll be able to look at the Atir-Yannick theorem in a more friendly way, more friendly for me, but also more friendly for applications. And we'll use the definition that I'm about to give you to prove the index theorem next time, just to advertise that, you know, you should pay attention. This is a good definition I'm about to give you. Okay. That's the question. Should have a question mark. So I'll describe the answer. Unlike the Atir-Yannick theorem, where I actually more or less told you why the answer was the answer, more or less proved the Atir-Yannick theorem, I shall not prove this theorem. This theorem is a much more difficult theorem, but it's easy to describe. This theorem is due to Kasparov. It requires that we master a little bit of terminology, which is one of the things I'm here to try and pitch. I think this is the thing that I'm about to describe, which is due to Dixmier and Duhaidi. Is a very good thing for index theorists of all stripes to bear in mind. So we need a few definitions. I want to generalize the concept of Hilbert space to a family of Hilbert spaces. I want to generalize the concept of operator, Fredholm operator, let's say, to a family of Fredholm operators. And I want to broaden the Atir-Yannick theory in this respect. And I want to indicate to you that even after you've broadened the concept of what a Fredholm family is, nonetheless, the same Atir-Yannick theorem holds. And moreover, this broadened notion answers this question here beautifully. So here we go. It's very simple, actually. I want to tell you what a continuous field of Hilbert spaces is. Parameterized by some space X, which is either a compact space or at least a locally compact Hausdorff space. Well, first of all, it's just a family, a set of Hilbert spaces. Just a big disorganized collection of Hilbert spaces, just a set. But now we're going to try and glue them together in some way which makes the family deserving of the term continuous. And we'll do that not by putting a topology on the disjoint union, which is what you do when you build a vector bundle. It's much more convenient to do it in the following way. To consider as part of the data the space of continuous sections. So we'll just call these the continuous sections. And then there are some axioms. I won't write them all down. They'll actually be in the notes if you're interested. But just to give you the gist of it, here's what we should have. If I have a section, I have a map from the space X into a various number of Hilbert spaces, a disjoint union of a bunch of Hilbert spaces, I can get an honest function out of that section by taking the norm function on the Hilbert spaces. And what should result should be a continuous function. So if I send X to the norm of S of X, where S is one of these continuous sections, this should be continuous. That's absolutely crucial to make the whole thing work. What else? Well, the continuous sections They should be a module over the continuous functions on X. We're talking about sections here. This sort of module structure is not the same one that you see in this definition here. Here we're just talking about one Fredholm operator, so it's a bit unfortunate. We made a bit of a jump from this board over to here. And some other things. For example, you'd like to know that this is the space of all continuous sections. You'd like to know that anything which is a uniform limit of continuous sections is a continuous section, because that's the way continuity works. Okay, and so that's built into the axioms. They're not very complicated, but I won't bother writing down the whole thing. I'll just give you the gist like this. Okay. Now an operator, a bounded operator, is what? Well, it's exactly what you think. Should be a family of bounded operators, one on each of the fibers of this continuous field, and it should map continuous sections to continuous sections. It should be exactly what you think, except for reasons which are not essential for anything that I'm going to discuss, but come up in other parts of the theory, we require the adjoint, the pointwise adjoint, to be continuous too. So you write down the obvious definition of what a continuous an operator on a continuous field should be, and you insist that that should apply to both the family of operators and the pointwise adjoint family of operators as well. Then you get the right definition for various purposes. This is a small technical point. It's not worth going into. It's completely irrelevant to everything that we're going to discuss in these lectures. And now we want to talk about Fredholm operators. And the correct way of doing that is to take the theorem of Atkinson that we discussed earlier as the definition of what a Fredholm operator should be. And for that purpose, I need to tell you what a compact operator is on a continuous field. Let's see how we're doing here. So we have one of these continuous fields parameterized by a locally compact space. Well, we shall define compact operators. This is not how it's done in Banach space theory, but here's how we'll do it. We'll define compact operators as norm limits of finite rank operators. And now I just have to tell you what I really mean by a finite rank operator. So we shall take a section, and I want to build from a section a new section in a way which looks like, at least fiber-wise, is a family of finite rank operators. So we'll just look at some sort of finite sum like this. Here's what I could do. I could take a bunch of sections, T, I, and I could take their pointwise inner products with the S's, and then I'd get a continuous function. And I could use that continuous function to multiply by other sections like this, Ri, and I'll get myself an operator from sections to sections. Okay? If our parameter space consisted of one point, every finite rank operator could be a continuous finite rank operator could be expressed in this way. This is how I'm now going to define finite rank operators in general, and so how I'm going to define compact operators. And there's just one little footnote here, which is that the Ti and the Ri are sections whose norms vanish at infinity. That's important if the space is locally compact but not compact. C0 sections. Sections whose pointwise norms, these functions here, are functions which vanish at infinity, extend by zero to the one-point compactification. Okay. Oh, and so now a Fredholm operator is simply one which is invertible modulo compacts. Modulo these things. Those are three definitions. They're basically due to Dixmier and Duhadie from the 1950s, who studied these continuous fields, which have some various interesting properties. Maybe we'll talk a bit about that next time. At least I want to get to Kasparov's antecedent here. Let me make a couple of observations which are very striking, in my opinion. This really nails down, shows you the whole point of this definition. Suppose I have one Fredholm operator . In other words, I'm just imagining that X is a point. So we just, after having told you what continuous fields are, I'm just telling you for the moment to forget about them. This is just a Hilbert space, and this is just a Hilbert space, and this is an operator. Now I'm going to do something interesting, which is I'm going to construct a homotopy from this operator to something much simpler, which is something totally, I mean, it doesn't make sense in the sense of the space Fred, but it makes sense perfectly in the context of continuous fields. Let me build a couple of continuous fields. Let me call them big H0 and big H1. So this is a continuous field over the unit interval. And what are its fibers? Its fibers are all copies of the Hilbert space H0, except at the number 0, where the fiber will just be 0. The 0 Hilbert space will be over the number 0. So I have a continuous field of Hilbert spaces, I'm claiming, but the continuous field does not have constant fiber dimension. It's a constant field everywhere except at the origin, and at the origin, the fiber is just the 0 Hilbert space. And in order to make this into a continuous field, I have to tell you what the continuous sections are. I get to tell you what the continuous sections are also, and here's what I'm going to do. I'll say that any section is continuous if and only if it's a continuous function from the unit interval into this Hilbert space, H0, which vanishes at the origin. Okay. And of course, I'll define H1 in the same way. Actually, these are provisional definitions because I got to do here's the fact. Suppose F that I want to point out. Suppose F is invertible. Suppose its index is 0. In fact, suppose it's an invertible operator. So let's define a family of operators, big F, from big H0 to big H1, just to be F in each fiber. This is a Fredholm operator. You can check the definitions. If you're a student, you have to check the definitions. This is a Fredholm operator in the sense of continuous fields. So if you like, it's a homotopy in the sense of continuous fields between the invertible operator F and the zero operator. So f is homotopic to the zero operator from 0 to 0. And what I've just described can equally well be done for families as it can be done for a single operator. In the world of the traditional Itier-Yannick theorem, if I have a continuous family of Fredholm operators, which is fiberwise invertible, it's very difficult to see that that family is contractible, that family is homotopic to a constant family. In this funny world, if I have a continuous family of Fredholm operators and they happen to be invertible, they constitute an invertible family, then that family is homotopic to the zero family between the zero Hilbert space and the zero Hilbert space by the world's most trivial homotopy. It's hard to believe that this could be a legitimate homotopy, and yet the theory itself could not be totally vacuous. But if you spend 30 minutes tonight thinking about it, you'll see that this thing that I'm claiming is a Fredholm operator would not be a Fredholm operator if the original F was not actually invertible. So it's a very interesting definition. It almost looks dumb. It almost looks completely devoid of content, but it isn't. There's something which is captured by this because of two facts, and this is the last board, I hope. First of all, what we've captured, or what Kasparov captured, what Dietzmeier and Duhadi captured when they came up with these definitions, is exactly enough to replicate the Itier-Yannick theorem. So there's a sort of improved Itier-Yannick. Which says that the K-theory of X, one of the ways that this is an improvement is that this is true whether or not X is compact. This is also true for locally compact spaces. The K-theory of X is exactly the space of homotopy classes of what I'll call Fredholm families. I can spell it. Of Fredholm operators on continuous fields over a space X, over the space X. A homotopy, by the way, would just be a Fredholm operator on the field X times the unit interval. This theorem is easier to prove than the Itier-Yannick theorem because you have recourse to these incredibly casual homotopies, which really are homotopies. And then there's the theorem of Kasparov. This is also due to Kasparov. But here's Kasparov's big theorem, which is, let me call this K0 for K-theory, is the following beautiful and simple answer to Atiyah's question, which has now disappeared, which is that the companion homology theory, K-homology, is exactly the same sort of thing. It's the space of homotopy classes of, well, we don't want to be talking about families of operators now. Atiyah's idea was that a single operator should give a class in K-homology, so we shall not be talking about families, but we will use the technology of continuous fields in order to describe what we mean by homotopy classes. That's where the idea of continuous fields is coming in. And what should we put here? We'll just put here Fredholm C of X modules. So I already described what a Fredholm C of X module is, and the language of continuous fields is only used to describe the equivalence relation, the notion of homotopy, which is appearing here. This is what Atiyah was looking for and did not find, and this is what Kasparov found. It's the most beautiful and simple answer you could possibly conceive of, and it turns out to be correct. So this is a good place for me to stop. Thanks very much.